Cosmic Flower. And tonight, hey, we have another, I think, going to be kind of different show, because I specifically am going to be talking about a more narrow subject, at least narrow in the sense that it's not way out there in Never Never Land. It's on esoteric psychology, which is actually a big part of some aspects of metaphysics, but still a relatively smaller part. And besides that, I'm going to try to focus in on causes of psychosis. Now, you might say, why psychosis? Well, if you recall from some earlier shows, I tried to explain that psychosis is the primary cause of most of the mass, quote-unquote, killings, which includes the use of guns. And that if we don't treat that problem, unless we totally ban all guns, it's not going to change the net result. And guns, to me, are a necessary freedom in order for people to be able to defend themselves and to allow them to, we'll say, keep the government within check. And you might say, the government within check? Are you some kind of paranoid guy? Well, if I am, then I'm in good company, because most of the founders of the United States, their primary reason for keeping weapons was not self-defense. It was to protect themselves from the government, and to prevent the government from seizing powers that it was not supposed to have under the Constitution. The second main reason was to defend yourself, because then, as well as today, when something bad happens that is unusual and, we'll say, severe force applied against a person, unless they have a weapon to defend themselves, the results are oftentimes disastrous for them. The reason being that although we have police and there are other ancillary people around to be of some help in case someone is attacked, they mostly only investigate crimes after they take place. They're just not going to be there to protect you. So it is our job to protect ourselves or to pay the consequences for not doing so. And without the ability to bear arms, which includes firearms, then it would be virtually impossible for most people to adequately protect themselves, and especially women, more so than men, because if the perpetrators of a crime be a man, they generally have, in most parts of their structure, more strength than a woman, on an average. Some women are very strong. Some men are very weak. I got all that. But if we take it on averages, that's the way it works out. Now, that's just the way it is. So from that standpoint, we have to look at psychosis as being a major contributor to the destruction of possible freedoms that are being eroded right now, as I speak, by Congress and the President of the United States. And they're eroding it in ways in which it won't change the outcome other than to erode our freedom. And it may end up being unconstitutional. You see, the idea in the Constitution isn't just that you have a right to have a firearm. It says that that right shall not be infringed upon. Now, infringement includes the ability of choice of what firearms you use and how many bullets you may have available to you. Maybe you have terrible shots. You might need 20 rounds, or you might need 2 rounds. But the point is, it shouldn't be infringed upon. And then, in addition, there are other factors. But I want to go a lot deeper than the question of that issue, which we covered before. The whole idea of dealing with mental health and the idea of esoteric psychology, which goes deeper than just health issues, is that within the human element, the most important part of being a human being is the part we call ourselves. And if that part becomes in any way disrupted or we'll say change to become something that is not healthy in the sense of being enlightened, godlike, helpful towards growing life. And if it does anything near the opposite of those things, then it is destructive to a person, to their soul and their soul's mission, and to the rest of us who in our soul mission together. So this is a huge issue, much bigger than guns or any of that stuff. It's so big, as a matter of fact, that I cut it down today to the causes of the psychosis, hoping that we'll get to some of the other aspects of esoteric psychology and how the self is changed in ways that is worse than, we'll say, what most people consider to be within the realm of quote-unquote normal, or less than or altered from being what most people consider to be normal. Normal, by my standards, is based upon how much light, how much virtue, how close it is to being connected to the soul that it is. And as it moves away from that perspective, then it becomes a real problem. That's the esoteric part of psychology. It's the soul part. So esoteric, which means hidden, what's hidden from us is how psychology affects our relationship to our soul and to everybody else's relationship to their soul. So it's a big deal. It's not a small deal. And we'll get into that tonight. I do want to say that tonight's show is going to be dedicated to someone I know named Laura. And for reasons which I'm not going to reveal, this show may be of particular interest to her. But it should be of great interest to many other people. And I think that, you know, I have done or touched on shows in esoteric psychology before, mostly when I was at another station, KXAM, here in Phoenix. But when I did those shows, there was too little time. It was a broadcast show, normal broadcast, and I had about 47 minutes. And, you know, these days I'm enjoying a great deal more, like in the 150-minute range, a three times longer show, which allows this subject to be explored in a way that does it some justice and doesn't put it on such a fast track that most people go, huh, what do you say? And even if they re-listen, they don't get it because there's just not enough time to develop a reasonable amount of examples and give better concepts that are bigger, but, you know, for most people, it can't hold in their head. And so give better concepts that are bigger, but at the same time, because there's more time to explain them, people can understand them. Okay. So let's start off with what makes humans so unique, and so unique that in comparison to most other forms of life, humans develop a particular kind of or set of illnesses, significantly different than most other life forms, other than those that usually have contact too much sometimes with human beings. And that is, humans develop mental and emotional unhealthiness. That's, in other words, it's an illness that you don't find readily in animals very often, unless they have a lot of contact with human beings. And then we induce it in them by our overbearing nature in comparison to what they are. Now, there are some examples in the animal kingdom of we'll call minor kinds of mental and emotional illnesses. But those examples are relatively rare in comparison to humans that seem to have these problems all over the place. And as a matter of fact, it's unusual rather than usual that a person within their entire lifetime won't have some kind of emotional or mental disturbance, if not illness. Isn't that strange? And we don't realize that this is a common occurrence. Now, I'm including things like addiction, which is considered a behavioral problem because it's convenient to do so these days so that the government won't have to pay as much for the treatment of people like this, and they classify it as a personality disorder. But in reality, that's just still part of the whole game, as well as a lot of other problems that people have that go pretty much untreated and even sometimes unrecognized. If you fail to be able to sleep in a normal way, that truly has an underlying psychological or esoteric psychological reason, but it may not be described within a context of a psychological or mental emotional illness. So we have very interesting problems here, but they are oftentimes overlooked and sometimes not even by definition diagnosable. There are many other forms of, we'll say, disorder that people have that would be definitely, in my mind, a psychological condition that is not readily recognized. Another problem today is that most of the diagnoses are based upon external behavioral issues and sociological factors rather than dealing with the real cause. As a matter of fact, there was a better understanding of the real causes when I was in practice in the 70s and early 80s, and before that, than there is today. We have gone backwards in terms of our understanding. Now, why would that be true? Well, because to understand the human nature, it requires that we let go of our biases, egotism, lack of understanding, and be open-minded enough to see the real causes. Okay, I'm going to tell you now that there is a single real cause in human beings that causes almost all of the, we'll call it emotional, which is the astral body diseases, and the mental body diseases. And that is, are you ready? Da-da-da-da. It's a lessening or a distorting or a damage to the self of the person. Now, what is the self? The self is the part of us that is conscious of who we are in deference to what and who everything else is. It is the part of us that can identify with not only ourselves, but in humans, it's particularly true, we can identify with the feelings and thoughts of others. Others can be people, of course. It may also be, in some cases, some animals, not so much so plants, but and not so much lower animals, but higher animals we generally can't. And so the self is the part of us that does all this stuff. And animals have a very limited self in them if they are advanced, and particularly if they are around people. If they are not around people, they lack the self. And there's a reason for that. Now, this is the esoteric part of tonight's show. The reason they lack self is because they don't have an individual soul. The self of a human being comes from having an individual soul and a connection with that soul, which is strong enough to maintain this, we'll call it, differentiation of us and everything else, as well as the association and recognition of similarity between us and some other thing. We get that from having our soul connected to us on an individual level. It makes us individuals, not just individuals because we have one quirky behavior or another. It makes us individual because we design our life to be so by the choices we make and the associations of those choices in consciousness connected to all the other choices we make and other people make. So we bring together and self-create ourselves. Animals cannot do this because they need an individual soul or the borrowing of a piece of our individual soul to help them. And they don't have it in general. What they have is called a group soul. The group soul is what we are used to calling instincts. The group soul gives animals complex patterns of behavior, which are the same as all of their similar animal types. And those instinctual behaviors allows them to behave in most circumstances without having to be conscious of why they're doing what they're doing and why others are doing what they're doing. They don't need that to be able to behave. Humans do. We don't have instincts. And if we don't have a self, we don't get it. We don't understand why anybody's doing what they're doing. And we don't understand why we're doing what we're doing. Okay? You got that? So the self becomes the big part, the huge part of this whole picture. Most psychologists today do not know what a self is. Same is true of most psychiatrists. Now, if you are following what I just said, and if it's true, we have a big problem. Because if the fundamental problem with the psychology of human beings is that there's something wrong with their self, and we're going to go through what those things are tonight, much as I have time for it, then how in the heck is it that it's going to help people to get better from their emotional and mental illnesses? That is a big question. Okay, now, I would like to go back about 30, 35 years ago, and I will tell you that the self was pretty much better understood because there were great psychologists going back to James and Freud and Adler and Jung, and after them, and these psychologists were also psychiatrists, but they were scientists in the study of the mind and the self, not just the question of writing out prescriptions for things that didn't exist at the time, by the way. And their attitude was that there were probably, in some cases, chemical changes taking place in the body. Even then, they thought that. But they didn't know what they were. And even if they did, they didn't have any way of, we'll say, altering these chemicals in a meaningful way. And they dealt with the issue more from the standpoint of the self. They may not have used that word. They might have been using the consciousness of the person. Or they might have been using the words of, well, we're trying to get to the conscious versus subconscious elements of the person. Today, in esoteric psychology, the subconscious is referred to as the personality, but in those days, the personality was considered an extension or a piece of the self. And the distinguishing element between the personality and the self was not a matter of being subconscious to the self. They called that, well, if you were a Freudian, you called it the id, I-D. Some others called it the collective unconscious. Collective meaning that it was more similar to instinctual issues and also animal-like behavior, more by drive. But drives are different than instincts, and that was later discovered and later explained by different psychologists and psychiatrists. A drive is just the need to have something on a universal scale with others of the species, whereas an instinct is a complex pattern of behavior. Humans have drives, animals have instincts. All right, so our drives are just to keep us going, and our subconscious part of us, which I call the personality, gets us going in that direction. It keeps us alive. It keeps us in control of ourselves and our world. The self part of us, the conscious part, still needs the subconscious part because we don't want to be belabored with every small thing that we are having to deal with in terms of processing our senses and the information coming in. It would be overwhelming. And there's actually a disease that causes that, overwhelmingness, and causes people to have a big problem. It's in the category of neuroses and OCD. And the defense to it is to develop an OCD. So if you have too much information coming in, you got a problem. And the problem is that instead of your subconscious trying to deal with it, it's too much is filling up your conscious mind. And so you constantly do repetitive things. Or if you're autistic, you may constantly do any physical or emotive behavior to deal with too much emotional content, but that's an astral problem rather than a physical information problem. Too much astral information leads to autism, Asperger's, and all these other ones, whereas too much physical information, and you might be an OCD guy or person. Okay, that's just an aside. And if you didn't understand what I just said, I'm only saying that for the people who are really into this stuff, because they're going to want to know, well, what does this say? What does that say? So I mentioned it only so that we cover that before the end of the show. Really, today we're going to be centering in on the causes of psychosis, but I'll throw out here and there enough information to fill in the spots where people are going to be interested, maybe on a more individual basis of things. All right, so the self is so unique in a human being because our self is gigantic compared to any animal. Huge level of self. That means a huge level of consciousness. Consciousness is the ability to join together different parts of knowledge and to create new choices and to be more inventive than we ever could have been otherwise. It gives new direction to every choice we have. And from that, we grow in a synthesis way, building ourselves from one thing to the next, growing at tremendous leaps and bounds. In the beginning, the self of a child is very slow in development, but it gains speed because it's not just geometric. It is truly, this is true. It is truly reaching a point where it is exponential, meaning it multiplies on itself, and it becomes so large that it's hard to even keep track of the growth of self in a person past about the age of 10. Up to 10, you can actually almost plot it, and you can see it going up, 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 and then it just suddenly explodes so much that you can't really even, it's too big. I mean, maybe a supercomputer could kind of document something, but it really is enormous how fast we can grow in ourselves. Now, some people say, well, isn't it true that people who have really bad kind of mental problems, they regress? Yes, they do regress. How about that? And as a matter of fact, psychologists today oftentimes still mention regression without mentioning that it comes from a shrinking or a reduction in the self. Oh, I got it. Now, just to further define this a little bit, I'll mention that sometimes the self is not just diminished, sometimes it's twisted, and it mostly turns towards the dark side. Then you have what is called characterological disorders, sometimes referred to also as personality disorders, where the person somewhat subconsciously, maybe somewhat consciously under certain circumstances, chooses to deliberately do destructive things to others, and the reason they do is because it makes them feel better when other people's self is lessened. This can lead to criminality, it can lead to sociopathology, or it could lead to psychopathology, which is trying to not just destroy the self of others, but eventually the life of others. So those, all of these various personality disorders come from the twisting or the distortion of the self. And then we have another kind of self, that problem, besides just the diminishment of self, and that other kind has to do with a self that has weaknesses. Weaknesses in various specific areas that a person is unable to deal with. Those are called, generally, the neuroses. They manifest themselves under odd circumstances and are kind of categorized by the areas of a person's we'll say behavior, that are affected by them. They tend to develop high levels of anxiety, which may either be hidden from the person, which is called a bound level of anxiety, or they may be freely expressed, in which case the person is like a shaking, can't maybe handle their own physical responses to things, and may have a great deal of trouble sleeping. So all of these kinds of, we'll call it self-changes, have different expressions, but they still come from what? Something's wrong with the self. Now, I want to also mention there's really two kinds of self. There's the self that we develop that has to do with us. And then there's the self we develop that helps us to help other selves to develop. That's more of our soul self, or is our soul self. And it comes from a part of our soul referred to by some people as the inner guide, or the angelic being connected to us. Or there's a lot of stuff, right? The point is that this higher self only deals with helping to help other selves become higher themselves and become more soul-like. Wow. So that's a part of us that always exists except in rare people. Some people who have very badly twisted selves, or lower self, can't any longer respond to their higher self. So they may lack a conscience, because part of the higher self is our conscience. And they also may lack any expression of light or godliness within themselves. That's when you get into the sociopaths or psychopaths. But so we're starting to see that everything seems to center around this self. Why don't animals have a self? Animals do not need to be aware of or help to create more of God on a conscious level. That's not clear. That's not who or what they are unless they are closely associated, as a pet usually, with a human being. They just don't do that. How do we know they don't do that? Well, have you seen any animals marching off to church? Have you seen any animals building any churches? Have you seen any animals collectively working for the common good? Common good being the help of things outside of their own breed or genetic structure. They may work together if they're running in a pack or if they're working in the oceans, hunting fish and swimming together, or if they're penguins at the South Pole, but they don't work together for animals that are completely different. As an example, you wouldn't probably find penguins out serving whales, even though they exist in the same general area in some circumstances, because to them, whales might be something they fear, as well as they don't see the commonality of their connection to the animals through God. They respond with light or virtue to themselves. They love each other. They serve each other to some extent, but along instinctual lines and not on any individual level unless they have a lot of contact with the human being. Amazing. Amazing. Now, I shouldn't say not without, because there are some very rare exceptions, even without human beings. There have been a few very rare exceptions of animals exhibiting some slight godlike connection. That's probably because that particular animal did have, believe it or not, in a prior lifetime, some connection with the human. That gets into so many esoteric issues, it's difficult to further explain. But those are so rare. We're talking about a few times a year, maybe, on the whole planet, something like this happens. This is not the kind of thing we are used to. Instead, the herds and the large numbers of all the different animals behave as though they don't have consciousness of God, because they don't. They have a subconscious part of them that wants to do good for those that are close to them, and they will. But they don't love God. They just love themselves and a few other kinds of animals similar to themselves. You see the difference. All right, so we are so different, but yet, unfortunately, evolutionists want to put us into a kind of animal category. We're just another animal. Are we? Okay. So esoteric psychology says that human beings aren't anything like animals, are instead a unique kind of life that has a self, a lower self, and it could be, and it often is, connected with the higher self, and it distinctly is different from other creatures. Yeah. All right, so what about psychosis? Because psychosis is possibly the worst, most destructive form of a mental and somewhat emotional disorder. There is a significant element or change to the self in a psychosis. That significant change is most often described as a loss of self or diminishment of self. That's when the self just shrinks down, and you can actually define it by age. The MA. So the person's age in mental terms is, and also astral or emotional terms, is reduced to a very lower number of years. Someone might be, let's say someone's 30 years old, okay, and they develop some form of psychosis. They may start reducing their overall age of self by as much as a year every couple of weeks, or faster. And if this occurs, in the beginning, it may just look like they're becoming a little more disorganized, a little less capable, childlike in some situations, adolescent-like in some situations. But the point is that it progresses. It gets worse and worse. And as the self diminishes, the person needs a defense or a way of dealing with the tremendous amount of fears, anxiety, that they fear. Anxiety comes from repressing fears and anger. And so they repress some of their fears, they repress some of their angers about and frustrations about not being able to have a self. And the loss of self is the greatest fear of death. So this is when we say we're afraid of death, humans, and animals, by the way, have a lack of fear of death. But humans have a huge fear of death because death is the fear of loss of self, not fear of loss of physical or body. People are relieved when, after they die, they are still alive in the etheric realm for a short time and then go to the astral world and realize they're going to keep living in consciousness. They have a different kind of world they're living in, but they still are alive. As long as people have consciousness, death is not, at least it's very minimal in terms of its fear that it induces. But if you start losing consciousness, even if your physical body and astral and mental are still alive, the fear of death becomes incredibly, incredibly oppressive. And this fear is then repressed by the personality or the subconscious part of us. Because as the self goes away, the personality says, what am I going to do? I can't deal with it. My job is to keep control over us. I'm being the personality now. My job is to keep control over us. My job is to make sure that we stay alive. And my job is to make sure that myself, the conscious part of me, remains. And for some peculiar reason, every day I wake up, myself's getting less. Therefore, I am afraid of death. I've always been a little afraid of death, but now it's right here in front of me. Well, the fear is so petrifying that the personality creates two general categories, two general ways, but they can mix together. You can have one form being represented in the other occasionally, but it generally magnifies one of these two more of the time, and so we call them two different ways of defending the loss of self. Make sense? Maybe. Let's go into it further and see if we can get to it better. Okay, so there's two kinds of loss of self represented as a defense by the personality's repression. What is it repressing? It's mostly repressing fear, but it also represses anger. The anger is because, well, you'd be angry too if someone's taking yourself away and you don't know how or why. But it's more about fear if you're talking about the psychosis. Okay, and so it represses this tremendous fear of dying. And the fear causes someone to want to avoid the whatever it is that they're fearing, and in this case, death. So it wants to avoid death. Got to avoid death at all costs, right? Well, in the first category of psychosis, the way the personality deals with the fear of losing the self is to say, hey, I got a solution. Since the world that we presently live in, we can't deal with anymore because the self is diminishing, I'll invent a world that we can live in through our imagination and through altering what senses, what information I gather through our senses, I'll just change it so that myself will feel better. And I, the personality, will not have to be even more repressive of the fear of death. The fear of death still remains, but it is not there every second, and it's like a relief of the anxiety which comes from repression. Even if you repress anything, I don't care if it's fear or anger, and there's some other things you could repress. There are sexual feelings, people sometimes. Whatever they repress leads to anxiety. That's the result. You get anxiety. And so the anxiety goes up when someone is functioning in a loss of self. Always goes up. But one way to handle the anxiety is to develop a psychosis. Believe it or not, when you're actively psychotic, your anxiety level goes down. If someone gives you a drug that reduces your psychosis, it actually raises your anxiety level. Isn't that interesting? And sometimes they'll give you a drug for the anxiety, but they fight each other. You get one drug is fighting the other drug in terms of what it's doing. All right, so this is very strange, isn't it? But this is how it works. I'm trying to show everybody what we're really dealing with when we talk about psychosis. So psychosis is really a way of handling a seemingly impossible situation by a personality, by the way, which itself never gains much more than mental age of 10. It in itself, it has to have itself to get much beyond 10 years old. And as the self diminishes, the personality's age also diminishes. So a person might end up being half the age, even subconsciously. Unbelievable is the best way to describe this horrible. We're going to talk a lot more about this and all the other issues involved and examples and what we can do about them, the solutions. I'm not going to just throw out a bunch of stuff and leave you hanging. And maybe we'll get beyond causes of psychosis tonight as well, but I wanted to make sure we will cover this because it is formidable and extremely dangerous. Okay, so we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about esoteric psychology. That means the hidden parts of psychology for most people, and the causes specifically of psychosis, although we will talk a lot about other things as well, I hope, if we have enough time. I'm going to make sure that we do cover the psychosis subject because it is affecting our society a lot these days. So, at any rate, let me continue on. We stopped with the first kind of defense of the personality to developing a loss of self. And if loss of self is defined to it as a tremendous fear of death, it becomes so radically fearful of death that it starts repressing the fear. And in the repression of the fear of death, it simultaneously develops huge amounts of anxiety. What are the symptoms of this anxiety? Well, it starts off as being a sense of relaxedness, of agitation, an inability to certainly sleep. And when someone does sleep, the normal rhythm of the sleeping pattern is disturbed. There is oftentimes insufficient rapid eye movement. And there's also a lot of, dreams that deal with the fear, the subconscious or repressed fear of death. To the person, the dreams don't say that they're dying, but it makes them, it resembles the feeling of fear. Sometimes they are facing death, though, in their dreams. But in addition, there are two kinds of dreaming. There's non-rapid eye movement dreaming, which I define as the etheric dreaming, that we almost all go through first before we go to rapid eye movement. And all of the first part that is usually solution solving, it helps us to discover what to do tomorrow so that we can live better, is gone. So one of the things that we know from measuring people who have any kind of astral and or mental disorder is when it is distressing to their sleep pattern and they stop losing this etheric dream, where it gives us the ability to solve problems the next day, it's because we are so focused on some immediate and overwhelming fear that is being repressed from the surrounding environment. In psychosis, the fear is mostly of death, the greatest of all fears. And most fears relate back to death, by the way. But the actual fear of death is just too much when it is continuous to the personality, and it can only deal with it for a few minutes at a time before it starts developing very high levels of anxiety. A few minutes. And then it will repress the fear. But it starts, as it represses the fear, it develops more and more levels of anxiety. So it's an endless circle. It can't get out of the anxiety just by repression, because it builds more anxiety, but the anxiety moves from what is known as a free-floating type to a bound type. Bound just means you don't notice it at the moment, and then comes out later. Sometimes when you try to relax or sleep. Sometimes when you need to do something that requires a lot of focused attention. Sometimes when you need to do something that requires a lot of, we'll say, skill. All of these become ridden by the inability to do because the anxiety levels are too high. Again, because the fear of death is so high. Because the loss of self is taking place. All right. Now, I know some people are going to say, well, what causes loss of self? If you take a lot of drugs, that can cause loss of self. So you can have a drug-induced psychosis. Or if you take a very strong drug, even if it's not a lot and you're not used to taking it, you can cause that. Event that is overwhelmingly impossible for the self to cope with can cause the self to start to diminish. The self is fine when it has confidence that it can deal with most of what it is encountering. When it doesn't think it can, it starts to diminish itself and give up its consciousness for a subconscious state. That leads to it. What can be that? Well, any kind of super bad thing. Somebody breaks into your house and says, we're going to take everything you have, but we think we'll rape you at the same time. That's a pretty good, strong incident that could start the ball rolling. Usually you need something more than that, more for most people. It's usually related to, like, that happening every day or something, or every so often, to what can produce a psychosis. What else? Genetics. If you have a problem in a part of your brain where certain chemicals get out of balance and where neurons, instead of connecting together the way they're supposed to, connect together in strange ways. In other words, that the things that you think you are able to think about are disconnected and reconnected and rewired in new ways. This causes the self to quickly diminish. So genetics, if you have that genetic condition and it starts to develop at a certain age, you will start developing some loss of self. Okay? What else can cause a loss of self? Well, a loss of self can be caused by the constant harassment and destructive, we'll say, conditions of people who are exerting pressure on a person. The pressure may not be to do bad. It may be to do good. But if it is without their ability to change, then they could develop a psychosis. Or if they're already in psychosis, they will get worse. What else? If a person is exposed to too much disharmony and problems in other people's selves while they're having some problem with their own self, that could diminish themselves further, their self further. What else? If a person is involved with people or circumstances where everyone is doing dark, evil, bad, and they don't want to or can't stand it, if the results of that are continuous, they could start developing a psychosis. Most people develop psychoses pretty early in life, but there are certain ones that develop more in mid and later periods in life. The reason one kind of psychosis versus another, we'll get into that in a little while, because it's a little more technical, and it has to do with this defensive issue. Remember, what I'm telling you tonight is still an overview. To really understand this, we'd all have to go to school for years to study the nuances of the things I'm describing. It used to be that's what they would teach psychiatrists and psychologists, so they would understand this stuff. They don't do that much anymore. They being educational institutions, people who go into various intern programs and get clinical training, they don't teach it anymore. I don't know why. It's kind of like lost somewhere. Now, that means that most of what is being taught today has within it a loss of the concept of why things are happening. And that's a very bad place to be with your quote-unquote shrink. Because what are you going to do to help someone? I mean, if you don't understand why is they've got the problem they got? Hopefully tonight's show will be used by some of these folks who didn't get this training, maybe, or who ignored it or whatever, and they forgot it. So it can help them to rediscover this, because it's very important that we have it, of course. All right. Now, what are the, since the first kind of psychosis that is developed is a desire to escape into a different reality. In other words, the world as we know it is too difficult for us to deal with. But a world of our own making would be a lot easier. So the personality shapes a new world for the person to live in. The shape of this world comes from the creative imagination of the person, usually joining with some elements of partial concepts joined with partial thought forms. So they're not complete. And this whole thing is then supported by what the personality does. It processes information from the senses and creates knowledge. Well, the personality, once it gets into a very strong defensive mode, starts distorting the senses of the person. So they perceive something different, but that fits the created world or realities that it has invented for the self of the person to function in. And it actually creates what we call hallucinations and delusional systems of thought that add to and are supported by the hallucinations. It's a very strange system, to say the least. This whole package of the delusions, the hallucinations, the altered realities is called the schizophrenia. There's a bunch of them. Some of them produce states where the person reverts to infancy, some to early childhood, some to adolescence. But in any of the cases, the person's self is always matched to the delusional system. So a schizophrenia can be diagnosed in severity based upon how much the regression of the self is as it is represented in the delusional system of the person with the kinds of hallucinations the person is having. The other thing that the self does is it wants to project out most of the bad things that are happening to the person as being caused by something other than making its own self responsible for it. So it tends to come up with a lot of, we'll say, negative and even highly incorrect assumptions and beliefs about other people. Some of these beliefs and assumptions become collectively a paranoia or fear of other people, which is, again, covering the fear of their own death. And it really works well, because as long as they can continue to say that other people are causing their problems, then that gets rid of some of the fear of death, and then the paranoia helps them to feel better about themselves. And if, after all, someone is hunting them, doing something terrible to them, causing all the problems they have, then they can't be responsible for the fact that their lack of self isn't there to deal with some of these issues. Sometimes the paranoia is very limited, very narrow. So, believe it or not, in the present-day vernacular, instead of calling that a psychosis, it's called a paranoid condition, either lacking psychosis or only with psychotic unusual episodes. Stupid idea, right? It's like how many angels can dance on the head of the pin. It is an irrelevant issue because the person is only using the paranoia because of the limitation of self. And it's no different than some of the other quote-unquote associated psychoses, but unfortunately, because some people mostly exhibit only paranoia, psychosis is not discussed. And therefore, the concept of loss of self is not readily understood. It's hidden from the real cause of the condition, which doesn't help anybody, does it? And then you have this nebulous, well, is this paranoid? I don't know why it's paranoid. And people think paranoia is just excessive fear. It is not. It's both excessive fear and anger that is repressed. The anger is the frustration with not having a self that can do a lot of things that the person would like to do, and the fear is the fear of death. Put together, it produces this paranoid condition, but it's still part of a psychosis. It doesn't have to be part of the schizophrenia. It could be part of the other side of the fence, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes. But whatever it is, it's still part of every psychosis. We have so finely sliced the psychotic spectrum as to eliminate it as a real diagnosis. And it doesn't do much good because it eliminates the real truth, which is the self, and the diminishment of self is the problem. All right, so some folks have this. They have the paranoia. Others don't. Some have it occasionally. Some have it all the time. All right, what else? Well, the personality is not only developing paranoia, in some people sometimes, it's also creating hallucinations and voices. And that's a form of hallucination. And it is change-altering the information coming in to support the reality of a fantasy the person has about their life in themselves. The fantasy may never be revealed. Or if it is revealed, it is couched in terms that are acceptable to others. Isn't that weird? But that's the way we are. The nature of the human being, we're very, very, very concerned about other people. Yeah. Okay, but remember the psychosis is also having to deal with another problem. And that, or the personality, excuse me, and the psychotic condition has to defend against another problem, and that is that the person's connection to their soul is diminished. This is probably the bigger issue. I know that for some people, this is, they're going to say, oh, this guy's a nut. He's talking about the soul with psychotic. Well, if you want to believe that, that's okay. But let me explain, and then you can decide. The soul, by nature, wants to connect to the personality and the self together. It wants to join. It wants to have the lower self join with the soul's higher self. And it wants to join with the personality, so the personality itself becomes soul-like. Hard to imagine. But once the personality takes on this super role of protecting the lower self, it can't and doesn't want to deal with this joining with the soul because that in itself builds more fear in it. I know that sounds strange. Why would the personality be afraid of its own soul? Well, because it associates that with its own death in a paradoxical way. The soul provides, once it joins with the personality, the overcoming of the fear of death. It eliminates it eventually. But to the personality, in its perspective, it thinks that its soul wants to kill it. It wants to kill the personality because the personality says, I'm in control of this human on a subconscious level, and the person and the soul wants to take away my control. Therefore, it wants to kill me being the personality. And so the personality becomes in conflict with its own soul, particularly when its self, the lower self, is diminished. That means that people not only become fearful of death, they become fearful of light, fearful of good, fearful of God. Now, this manifests in several different ways. If they become fearful of God, they think God is going to punish them, and God is out to get them. Not a good outcome. If they become fearful of good, which is the expression of God in life, they become fearful of those people who can both help them and people who are more soul-like and virtuous. And if they become fearful of anything that deals with the concept of doing good and creating virtue, they become bad, disruptive, destructive, and easily possessed. As a matter of fact, if they get any of these conditions involving God, which starts pretty early in the psychosis, they are open to a thing called possession. Why? I mean, they might have been terrific good people a month before, and all of a sudden, they're open to be possessed by dark entities from the astral world, some of them who live in the lower astral subworld, and some who live in the A-sphere who are just objectively evil. How does this happen? Because the loss of self has triggered this increased concern for the soul swallowing the personality. Wow. And all of a sudden, a really good person can become a really bad person or follow a way that is both destructive to their in total and do the opposite of what is best for them and do what's worst and get involved with other people who want to do what's worst. So the whole system kind of sits together. Unfortunately, people who are psychotic are easily victimized by people who are either criminal or want to bend their will to control them or want to force certain things to take place. They become victims of the others, who are usually more personality disordered. But regardless, they become victims to the dark side in general, in humans. So psychotic people can become instruments of destruction because of this unique relationship that humans have to their own soul and to their lower self. Now, I know this is a lot to digest, but if we're starting to really reveal what is going on in our society, for the last 30 to 40 years, I know it sounds like a long time, there has been a movement caused by what is known as social progressivism to declare that all people, even if they're just completely out to lunch, insane, meaning that their psychosis has reached the point where they can't function at all, should not be confined, should not even be in most cases, have their rights taken away. They should be just treated like anybody else and given the right to choose and be free to do so. There has been a loss of knowledge, loss of consciousness, loss of professionalism of the profession of psychiatry and psychology to deal with this problem because of a political movement. Wacky. Wacky stuff. It started, if you want to know who it started with President Carter. How did it start with President Carter? Because he was a very left-wing kind of president, not nearly as left-wing as the present president, but still left-wing. And he believed it would be better if we did confine psychotic people to mental hospitals. And came up, his administration came up with the idea of changing the status of people who had any kind of psychosis. And then simultaneously they changed the status of people with drug problems, because drugs were a big problem then, as they are now, but even growing big problem then. And so they didn't want to have to treat everybody as having a mental health problem, so they classified drug addiction as something else. And all of this confused the entire mental health system. In the process, they closed mental health hospitals. They tried to save money in the wrong way for people out in the streets. All because left-thinking civil rights people believed that this was the humane way to deal with psychotic people. Well, we'll talk about how to deal with these problems later, but this was about as crazy as the psychotic people themselves. And it led to, within a number of years, I was director of a mental health institute at the time, and watching this occur was like watching the nightmare of all nightmares. People that would normally get some help, but there was a downside to it, because I agreed with some of the problems, a thing called institutionalization. People were being kept too long, locked up. But you had to lock them up for a little while, or you had to do something else to help them. I'll talk about what can be done. But the point is that instead they just said, well, now we'll close all the mental hospitals on the state level. We'll stop doing anything that will support that. And we'll rewrite, along with the psychiatrist, the diagnostic statistical measurement code. And we'll get a lot of insurance companies to go along with this, because they won't have to pay for a whole bunch of series of diseases, some of them called the personality disorders. And there will be a great, great relief on their part, the insurance company's part, and the government will not have to support things that don't seem to be liked by people anyway. And we'll become more popular, because we'll look like populists. But popularism is not necessarily a good way to run mental health. It just doesn't make sense. All right, so they did all this, and they did a lot more. The changes were huge. DSM-2B became DSM-3, which became a nightmare, because the erosion, which then became the fourth, and now they're working on the fifth, all these changes became social paradigms of the need of social progressives to have a society look the way they want it to look. And it also did away with any element of spiritual issues. The things I talked about a few minutes ago about possession absolutely were drummed out, even though it wasn't necessarily accepted psychiatry or psychology, even in the day. Things went from bad to worse, a lot worse. And something called psychotherapy was gradually diminished until today it almost can't be found, from what I've told. Just amazing. All right. So this took place, and the results are people who are mentally ill are sleeping in the streets, are going in and out of what we call mental institutions on a 24 to 48-hour basis, revolving door, are abused and used by people who are into other kinds of, we'll say, mental problems, which includes the drug-addictive personality disorders and other kinds of personality disorders and criminality. They are neglected. They are not seen as being curable or help, like you can help them. They're being given up on and have been for some time. And we don't notice them because they've been around so long, they are almost invisible unless they directly interfere with our movement, our talking, our presence. And they've learned not to do that, so for the most part, they are invisible. The danger is that they can be used by the dark side. The danger is they can, over time, they erode the virtue of even the good people because they are, the good people are ignoring them, making them less good by the fact that they are. Wow. So the contagion of not listening to your soul is not only in the mental patient, but in the people who ignore the mental patient or refuse to see the real problems of the mental patient and make up fake ones so they can either make money on them. Those are the professionals. They abuse these people by making money on them in non-effective treatments and in doing stupid and even harmful things to them. In addition, there's a whole slew of people that use them in many other ways. Sometimes they're family members. Sometimes they're neighbors. Sometimes they are strangers. But these people get abused all over the place. All right. So, wow. Looking at it from that angle, this is a blight on our whole society, and it started decades ago, and it's become like a cancer in our society and most other countries now. I think called the World Health Organization, has virtually memorialized all of this into a bunch of BS that they promote and try to standardize from one country to the next. The few countries that still have anywhere near a mental health system do so with erosion every year coming from this great body, with lots of pressure on it. To march in line with the rest of the uninformed and ignorant and arrogant professionals. Where do we go from here? Well, the schizophrenias are a serious problem. They are not the main side of psychosis. The majority of psychosis does not represent itself these days as schizophrenia. Most psychotic people choose the other side, called the manic-depressive side. Sometimes it manifests as more depression, and sometimes it manifests as more mania, and sometimes it manifests only one of the two. When it manifests as both, it's called cyclothymic. It just means a move back and forth on a regular basis, somewhat regular basis between the two. And how is this a defense to the loss of self? Well, in a schizophrenia, a person is trying to create a new reality. And the new reality is coming somewhat from their fantasies. It's distorting their senses. It does all that kind of stuff. It does affect somewhat the way they're thinking, too. There's no question about it, and they can become paranoid. But in the depressive and mania side of the expression of psychosis, there is a more substantial mood element or change in feeling that the person goes through. Now, why would a personality subconsciously want to change the feelings of a self that is diminished? Because the feelings are usually not the greatest feelings if they're depressed. Well, this is how it works. It says that, you know, to the subconscious, it says, hey, I can't stand the anxiety of the fear of death because I'm having such a loss of self. That's common denominator. I think that for a while, I will reduce the amount of activity that I energized from a mid part of the brain, and that also it happens in a part of the cerebral part, the thinking part of the brain, to the point where myself will decrease its desire to have action or activity in its life. And the person feels energetic and depressed as a result. It's another kind of depression that doesn't involve psychosis, but it doesn't come from a loss of self as much as damage to self, and it's a different kind of thing. It's a neurotic kind of depression. We'll talk about that if we have time. But in the psychotic depression, the clearest idea here is that the depression that the person experiences is pervasive, it's persistent, it doesn't come and go. They seldom have angry outbursts, if ever, and they almost have a limited form of passive aggression, but not constant passive aggression, which is a kind of hidden form of things. So almost all of their responses are fear responses and not anger responses. That's the best way to immediately know that you're dealing with a psychotic depression. The other thing is about psychotic depressions is the person doesn't want to do anything that reaches a certain developmental level. So if you say to someone, well, let's do something that a normal 15-year-old could do, and the person says no, and no matter what activity you suggest that's at the appropriate level of a 15-year-old, they don't, and they're actually 30, by the way, that is a sign that you, a pretty good sign that you have a psychotic depression. And then if you find out that all of their behaviors are 9 years old, and they also seem to, all the activities they want to do are at 9 years old, and it seems that they also limit those activities very successfully for that age through what they call to be their mood expression or their feeling. So the only thing they feel like doing is at that level. That's a clear indication, diminishment of self at that level. And you can diagnose it. It's not that hard to do. It could change. It could get worse and worse, too. Or it can improve with certain things we'll talk about. But as it gets worse, the things that they choose that they can do become less and less in an order of age capable of doing. So eventually they can only do like what someone 5 years old, 5 years old could do. And a six-year-old would do other things that they can't do anymore. And each thing that they choose to not be able to do, and they are choosing this, is a defense to their loss of self. And it's a psychotic depression. Wow. Now, how is that different from just someone who has only a depression? Well, if you have only a depression, you don't have as much a lack of self as much as some part of yourself became damaged. And it's more like a neurotic kind of thing. It became damaged about certain kinds of things, certain kinds of conditions. It may be that you can't leave the house, a kind of agoraphobia. But it's an agoraphobia that involves a tremendous amount of damage around the self interacting with people under certain circumstances. If people come to your house, you can interact. But if you leave the house, you can't. Why? Because the neurosis is about a specific thing the self is unable to deal with. A specific thing. Not all things. So neuroses have limited fears. The fears are very specific and intense about those things, maybe even more intense than a psychotic person, but it is in general. So because it's specific and it is only about the things that it's about, and the anxiety only comes when it's repressed about those things, the person's anxiety is limited in a certain ways, and they're not as afraid of death in general. You see, this is a very big difference, and it's very easily diagnosable, but to a person who's naive, they may not see it. They may not know the difference. And it's kind of scary because these days it seems as though people that are professionals are becoming less able to understand the difference because they don't know what the cause is, you see. The concept is missing. You can't figure out what's really going on. Of course, you've heard me say that so many times. All right, so now, what do we do now? What do we do if we got somebody who's into this depressive side? Well, if they're into the depressive side, you've got to change the way they are relating to both their lower self and their nature and soul. It's not as simple as typical examples in psychology. We'll talk about that more, but I want you to know there are answers. real answers for these potential serious problems. Also, certain chemistry can be evolved or activated in the brain up to a point, but it won't cure the person. It may slow down the regression, slow down the destruction, overall destruction itself. Not everybody chooses a depression. Some people say, hey, I think I'm going to be a little manic. What is mania? Mania serves the same purpose as the depression, but in a very different way. Instead of choosing things that the self cannot handle due to a specific age issue, the personality chooses or allows the self to choose to do certain things that actually are more advanced things in some circumstances, but only for short durations. It causes something called a flight of ideas. The person only chooses to pay attention, and the personality only supplies information for a short period of time to allow this to take place, so the personality is in control of it, and the self only can pay attention for minutes to hours or a day. And during that time, the self is allowed to actually involve itself with both people and do a lot of things, but it's scattered. It doesn't have much time to do anything, which is determined by the personality's input of information. And when the personality wants to just shut off the spigot, it cuts down the perceptual reality of that series of life, the input of that information coming into it. And then the person wanders to something else. It's still involved. It's still a psychosis. It's still involved with monkeying around with those senses. And in some ways, some people who are manic do have hallucinations. Sometimes they can become paranoid. So can people who are depressed. All these elements that you see in the schizophrenia can manifest in much more slight ways, but it isn't the main part. The main part is this hyperactivity and hyper-movement of ideas from one place to another. There's two different conditions. One's called hypomanic, where a person does it for maybe hours or a day. And then there's hypermanic, where a person does it for minutes or an hour, and where the flight of ideas is very pervasive. It just moves all over the place, it changes a lot. You get a major shift from one thing to another. And so that is a much worse condition, hypermanic. And those people oftentimes have much less basis for connection with reality. Both manias, types of manias, the hypo and the hyper, reduce a person's ability to understand what is real. But from the differences, they don't necessarily create new realities as much as they only deal with the superficial reality of some realities around them that they keep moving from one point to another. So it's kind of another way of dealing with a lack of self. If your self isn't strong enough to be able to deal with becoming a brilliant business person, you can become one for a few hours or a day. It's okay with that. And they'll move on doing something else. Or they'll jump off a bridge or do something else. Whatever they're going to do, it's going to be for a relatively short time, and it has a superficiality to it because the full concept of what it means to do that behavior is completely missing from their functioning. You see what I'm saying? Okay. Some people tweak between a hyper manic condition and a depressive state. And the depressive states have different levels to them. Some of them are very deep depressions, some of them are mild depressions, but mild just means that the amount of energicness to them is less. And so they have a bit more energy, they can do a few more things. But it still means that they're tremendously lacking in the ability to do almost anything above the level of where their self is. As the self diminishes, they can do less and less, and the fear of death becomes enormous. And so the illness progresses as the diminishment of self progresses and the regression takes place. And it goes faster and faster and faster. We have what is known as various points called fractures. In each fracture point, the person jumps from being able to have done something to now no longer being able to do that and diminished to a significant lower level of activity and ability. But then eventually the fractures amount to a break. When a person breaks, no matter what age they demonstrate, which might be 4 years, 3 years, 2 years old, they can't do anything in any meaningful way for themselves. A broken person in a depression becomes a person who usually has to be completely careful. This is a very dangerous state because even if they come out of it, building up the self from the break point is much more difficult than just from a fracture point. It takes a lot longer. And in some cases, more skill than is represented on the average in today's professionals. So there's maybe no place to go to get help, is what I'm saying. Okay, so this is the nature of the beast we're dealing with. These psychoses that I described have all kinds of fine differences that are more about behavior than they are about true psychology. Now, some of you are saying, wow, this is like going to doctorate-level classes. Yeah, well, look, I could talk in very, very simple terms. I've done that before, but it doesn't give enough understanding of the problem. Or I could start talking in very medical terms, which would lose everybody except for a few people who have been trained in those terms, which wouldn't do anybody any good, I think. Even the people who know about the terms, other than everybody say, oh, yeah, he knows what he's talking about. Yeah, I'm trying to find the middle ground here so that we can find a solution, not so that I can prove that I know something or that other people don't or whatever. The main important thing here is to present this in a way in which we understand enough to be able to do something that makes sense. And as a people, as a world, this is a big enough problem to be considered important, especially when we got people being abused at such high levels. Now, how much of the people are psychotic? It's relatively low. 1 to 3% of the population is psychotic at varying levels. And it depends what society you live in and all this other stuff. And you could say, well, how many people have neuroses? It's about double what the psychosis are. How many people have personality disorders? It's about double what the neurotic people are. Add it all together, how many people have some kind of problem? Pretty significant. Like it's maybe a fifth or a sixth of the population. But the point is that if you say how many people have a problem sometime in their life in one of these categories, it jumps. It goes much higher than that. That's the problem, is that we're all experiencing some of the nature of this because we're all experiencing attacks on ourselves. Some of it comes from the nature of the kind of world we're constructing for ourselves. This world has built into it the diminishment, destruction of parts, or the twisting of self. In many different ways. We are doing it to children by eliminating education that allows them to think. Also, we're doing it to children by reducing or eliminating all ideas of God. We're doing it to children by trying to get them to all learn the same things in the same way, even if they're allowed to think only about certain things in certain ways at certain times. All of those things diminish self. And later on, catch up with people. We do it by having families that are split or broken in numerous ways, usually by only one parent being present, or by having tremendous dissension between parents and siblings and other people, by having pedophiles running around harming children, by having a system in which we do not understand. understand how to raise children. We just don't. We've lost that art. We've given it over to schools, governments, systems that lie outside of family, and that reduces the individualization of the self and the soul nature of children in the process. We've done it in the educational institutions on the highest level of education. Institutions have become highly, socialized and promoting socialization, and also highly progressive, both social and economically progressive. What does this do? It leads to a sense of lack of self because it tells people that you don't live your life to be creative or individual. You live your life to be part of a system. And the justice of all is what counts rather than the creation of each. It's anti-God, as I am taught what God is. But it's worse than just being anti-God. It's actually evil. And so in the long run, we have a system which is promoting evil and destroying good. And this is affecting young people from the earliest years in childhood all the way up into college. It's very dangerous and it's very bad for everyone. It increases mental health problems tremendously because it diminishes self in numerous ways. This is no simple issue. It's a biggie. If you want your children to be mentally healthy, they need to live in a mentally healthy family, and they need to go to a healthy educational school, and then when they go into high school, and if they choose to go to college or to some other trade school or higher school, those schools need to be free-thinking, allow people to be creative and individual, and not follow some social agenda that's politically motivated by people who want to have control and power over others. A society in which that exists is a society which diminishes self on a regular basis. When we used to have serfdom, which is what we may be moving back in various parts of the world, serfs were almost invariably diminished in self. They had bad things called hysteria, which is a kind of personality disorder. It's both a neurosis and a twisting of the self at the same time. So you have a destruction of one part of the self while you have it twisted in another one. And so, and they had all kinds of other problems. This is more common. And you're going to say, well, why? Because they were slaves. The present systems in the large parts of the world today are to enslave the citizens in one way or another. Systems of government. And it's not by accident. It's by design for those who think they know better, who are arrogant and evil. Now, they may not be evil in the sense that they themselves know themselves to be evil, although most actually, I think, do. I think the majority do. That's it's hard to know the heart and mind. They certainly act as though they have malice of their own evil. But they still do what they want to do because they want to be in control. These things are coming to bear on us. They are making our society worse and not better. Now, this has always been around from time to time. In most places, it's been the main way people have existed. Here in the United States, it has been fought against, but it's a losing battle. We're far less free, far less creative, than we used to be, and we're moving quickly in a very bad direction. It leads to higher levels of mental illness. Much higher. So all the things I've said in prior shows about this subject of, we'll call it socialistic principles, etc., now is coming to bear in tonight's show in explaining some of the reasons that we have so much unsuccessful treatment of mental illness and so much mental illness in general. That is unrecognized. It virtually is going to be the norm. Interesting. The new healthcare system is the worst possible model are being used in what is known as Obamacare. Those models are so incredibly, quote-unquote, socialistic, communistic, progressive, whatever word you want to use, as to almost certainly going to maybe double the amount of mental illness, emotional illness in our country, and are going to formidably change society in the most dark and evil ways imaginable. Just that alone is coming next year. So, and it's starting this year. So we've got to be concerned then, if this is where we're headed and how things are coming about, then we've got to do some changes. This is not good, to say the least. We're moving in a direction that is against our soul. And every time this has happened in history, within a few centuries, nations disappear. And chaos. And great amounts of destruction of life occur. Not just human life, but destruction of beauty. And possibly even the world's own existence could be in jeopardy at this particular time. And a barometer is the emotional and mental health of our people. Okay, so the psychoses, as I describe them, have the most severe outcomes in the shortest period of time for a person in comparison to what we call neuroses or personality/characterological elements or disorders that people can have. These kinds of mental illnesses are so bad because the loss of self is general and global. The lower self is reduced in every way, or in most ways, for most people, on a fairly quickly fast pace, if left unchecked. And in a personality disorder, where the twisting of the personality takes place, I mean twisting of the self takes place, where the self becomes very selfish, very self-focused, and dishonest, deceitful, shallow, these kinds of problems can manifest gradually and in different ways over a whole lifetime. Sometimes they start very early. Sociopaths are thought to have existence of that kind of behavior before the age of 7. Not always, but some. And other kinds of personality disorders certainly develop through the teens and early adulthood. They are difficult to change. They can be changed, but it is not the norm. And I won't have time probably to talk about how to change them tonight, but they can be if you use the right methods and the person wants the change. They people who have these kinds of twisted selves and personalities that go along with the twisting of the self, generally don't want to change. So even if given the opportunity to, unless they are about to be put away in jail or some other radical reason, they don't want to change. So that's the common phenomenon. Sometimes they want to change a specific behavior because it becomes so destructive to them, such as an addiction. But they may not want to change their overall self because they're too selfish. And their concern or connection to God is too little. So that always is a big issue. The concept of the 12-step program, where God is part of it, is not a bad idea, provided that you could accept that kind of God. It would be better if the God of the 12-step program was a more universal approach to it, maybe something from Angel's Wisdom, but at this particular point, that isn't available in most places. But it is an important element, and it does help. Also, the people who have damage to parts of their self, the damage could be because of some significant parts of their childhood being disrupted and harmed in various ways. It can be other things, even during their adult years. Those people with the damage, which we call neuroses, can get out of them from time to time by facing these specific fears. Sometimes they use operant conditioning, which is like a behavioral approach to changing. And sometimes it works on those kinds of problems. But it's not the best way. The best way is to repair the damage in the self. Again, I don't know that we're going to have time tonight to talk about how you repair the damage to the self in this kind of neurosis. I doubt we're going to. But, I mean, you could have a whole course on that for sure, maybe a couple of years studying it, right? But it can be done. I'm just trying to explain in tonight's show that there is hope for this. You can do it. Do you use drugs? Rarely. For some of the anxiety parts, sometimes for short periods. But only certain kinds and preferably more natural things than pharmaceuticals, but whatever works sometimes is the best. But more often, you need to do something else. You need to reconnect the person to a higher concept of why they're living, to reduce the nature of the damage so that they repair it on a functional level on a daily basis. And they do so not just for themselves, which can develop more selfishness in them and possibly a concomitant personality disorder. I've seen that happen. People get over a neurosis to develop more of a personality disorder. Oh, that's not a good trade-off. Now, it's better to ultimately fix the damage. You've got to identify it and go directly at it through individual psychotherapy and then sometimes in a group therapy sessions and through a series of specific life experience changes so that the person gradually repairs this part of themselves, so that they actually use the self with the higher self. Once they do that, the repair is completed. They've got to do it for other people, not for their own selfish reasons. Once they get that going, the neurosis goes away. Wow. Really? Yeah. Mm. Okay. But what about the poor psychotic person? They've got this diminishing of self. It's ubiquitous on all parts of their self scale. They're quickly going down the tubes. What do you do? Well, the first thing you've got to do is stabilize. If they're showing signs of possession, which they often will, the first thing to do is to use what is called a neuroleptic kind of drug. Why? Oh, I don't like drugs. I thought you didn't like drugs. I thought you were into natural. I'm into naturals, but there's very few naturals that are neuroleptic because it's a very unnatural condition to produce in the brain. What does it do? It cuts down the activity of one neuron communicating to another neuron without deliberate thought involved by the person to get the neuron to do it, or a series of neurons. We're talking about billions of them, but get them all to do it only from the person deliberately forcing the thought. If the person doesn't deliberately force the thought, the neurons don't fire. Well, you could say, well, that's a strange thing. There's a drug that does that? Well, actually, there's a whole bunch of them. There's a whole bunch of neuroleptics that do this. Some of them do it with a lot of side effects, and some of the newer ones do it with less side effects. They all have some. Now you can say, well, why is this drug so helpful to a psychotic person? Well, let's look at what it does in the brain, and we can figure this out. It mostly first affects the cerebral part of the brain, part of us that thinks by our own efforts. Thinks by our own efforts. Most of that part, the cerebral part, thinks by our own efforts. The personality only controls the cerebral part of the brain through lower parts of the cerebral part of the brain and through what is called the midbrain. It doesn't deal with the cerebral part most of the time directly, because it's subconscious. The self deals with the cerebral part. Its job is to decide what part of all the information that has been turned into knowledge by the personality or the subconscious mind, it wants to bring into consciousness and make something new out of it. Now, in psychosis, when somebody tries to do this with a diminished self, there isn't enough regulation over the brain by the consciousness or the self to be able to control the neuronal activities so that the cells fire randomly and they don't keep thoughts in a single way directed towards a single purpose or eventually towards an action. The self doesn't have a grip on its own brain. The brain is mostly a tool. It's not the mind. Remember this. The self is more the mind. But the mind is something different from the brain. The brain is an organ. It provides necessary activities that control bodies. And it gets storage of both memory and knowledge. So it's important that it's a great storage device. It's like the hard drive. But it's not the CPU. The CPU is like the self. And the instruction set, or the machine code of the CPU, is the personality. Oh, boy, that's maybe a strange analogy unless you're into that sort of stuff. Okay. I know, the brain's the memory on the board, you know, it's got all the SIMs. All right. Yeah, we can take this too far, maybe. Let me go a bit further, though. So the self is trying to control the firing of these neurons, but not successfully, because it is diminished. Its thought is not strong enough to control the electrical energy in the brain. Energy follows thought greater than its own. Ah, a great esoteric truth. It's very much true in psychosis. So when the self can't do this, you've got to slow down the neurons because it gives the self more of a chance to feel in control. It allows the personality to relax a bit and not feel so fearful that it's going to die because it's losing itself. And the self gets a little bit of a rest. There is a downside. In order to think, the person's got to really focus on thinking because the neurons don't flow as easily. The neuroleptic is a blanket on the activity in the brain. Neuroleptic means literally it's reducing the action of the neurons. Oh, that's what it means. Okay. There are lots of them. The old ones, Thorazine is like going after a mouse with a hammer or maybe a shotgun. It's a bad, or a rat, a rodent. It's a terrible thing. Yeah, you've got all these things running around all over the place and you want to stop everything. But the Thorazine stops everything, and it does it like pouring tar on your brain. You can't really make things work very much at all, no matter how good you think. You give Thorazine to a genius, and they'll be drooling in an hour. And going, yeah, that's not the great drug you want to use, but that's all they had in the 50s and the 60s. All right. Then they came out with a bunch of other kinds of neuroleptics that were not as drastic. And gradually, over time, they found some that are pretty good. I mean, they're not perfect, but they're not terrible, and they do their job to some extent. The best ones are the ones that don't affect very much in the beginning the personality. Why? Why would you want that? Why not get the personality affected too? We'll fix it, right? No. It's causing all the repression in business. Well, when you start limiting the personality at the same time you limit the self, the personality freaks out even worse, and you get a springback effect, sometimes called reactive psychosis, to the drug. So you don't want to give somebody a drug that is a neuroleptic and then give them something that affects the midbrain, the hypothalamus and the limbic system, simultaneously, because if you do, you get the springback effect and the personality becomes even more fearful, even more hostile, even more resistant to treatment. Because it says, hey, wait a second. You can help myself, but you're not going to take away me because I'm here to be in control and now you want to get rid of me. I'm the subconscious. Leave me alone. Oh, am I being too dramatic about this? Maybe I am. I don't know. But that's really what happens. I've seen it happen too many times. I saw hundreds of psychotic people I was in practice and thousands that I was ancillary to their treatment in because I was director of the two different mental health institutes where not only was my psychotherapy practice involved, but it was also as the general clinical psychologist trying to help everybody else get their stuff into a, we'll say, the best possible model of treatment. And so I was equally involved in many cases with many of their psychotic patients. And I saw this very thing happen. They would give them, Navane, there's all kinds of stuff, Stelazine, Melaril, there's a hundred of them, right? All these different neuroleptics. But then there was also the attempt to, as new drugs came out on the more limbic part or the midbrain, to give certain kinds of antidepressants if the person was depressed, certain kinds of things that are going to, we'll say, affect the personality more, sometimes hypnotically. All these things have an effect that is not good on the midbrain. It comes in too fast, and it's causes a negative reaction. Eventually, the neuroleptics do have a slight effect on the personality that increases over time. Like after 8 or 10 weeks, it's mild. And the personality says, oh, it's not so bad. Okay, so it has an anoxialic or a reduction in anxiety effect itself on the personality. But it can take anywhere from 8 to 16 or 20 weeks before that drug actually affects them that way. And too many people, too many psychiatrists, want to do something right away. So they introduce too much that's too fast on the midbrain, and you've got a lot of negative. That doesn't help anybody. All right. What do you do then? Since the majority of psychosis these days is more in the depressive and mania side, what do you do with these folks? Best thing is a neuroleptic will help if it's the depressive side. It may help in manias too, by the way. The other thing the neuroleptic does is it blocks out the ability to become possessed very quickly. Within days to a week or two, the person becomes free of most possession. The possessing entities are trying to use their brain because it's so unusually easy to use, and they're not using it. Their self is diminished. They take over and they put thoughts in their head. Sometimes it's a really bad and strong possessing entity. These are mostly beings from the astral world. The worst thing is to find these monstrous things that exist in the etheric world and get possessed by them. That's real rare. When that happens, watch out, you're going to get people that become homicidal. But even those monsters are still controlled by dark ones in the astral world. Now, I know this stuff sounds crazy. Okay, humor me. So far I've said stuff that makes a lot of sense, right? So humor me for the stuff that you think is, you know, not so, right? Okay. Don't condemn me yet. Give me my day. All right, so these entities that are doing this stuff sometimes are multiple. It isn't one or two. It could be many. Sometimes it's one powerful food, and that's a real bad, that's worse. But in any case, the good news is the dualistics actually block out most of the possessing entities. They hate that stuff. Well, they really hate it. And it works fast. I mean, within a couple of weeks, for most people, the possessing entities are going away. As long as you don't introduce any other drugs, those people start getting better gradually. But the drug is not the cure-all, you might think. It does work on the brain, but the real problem is in the mind. The mind is the self, and the subconscious part of the mind is the personality. Yeah, the personality uses the limbic system, the hypothalamus, to exert some pressure, and some parts of the lower cerebral cortex, too. But it does so by using these things as instruments. It still is part of the mind, which is something entirely different. The mind actually exists more in the electromagnetic range of the etheric world, in the physical person. It also exists in the astral world and the mental world. There's a mind here, and they're all connected together. Oh, I know it sounds strange. I know you might think I'm nuts, but I'm telling you this is the truth, and I've seen it. I know. I have seen it in function. Won't go into that tonight. All right, so we have this unique situation that we've got to get the personality and the self to work together to rebuild the self. It's got to either untwist the self, if a person is personality disorder, characterologically problem, we've got to fix the damage in the self if they have a neurosis, or if they have psychosis, you got to build all of the self, gradually making it stronger. And the best way to do this, and the only way that is completely effective, is to do so with the higher self and the soul. The soul works with the personality, gradually, and the lower self is helped by the higher self, which is the self of the soul itself. So you've got to bring this about, and you do it by creating a model of treatment. That's the model of treatment. Okay? Which gives structure to the person. The structure is about how they're going to, on a daily basis, do certain activities or avoid certain other ones, how they're going to take notice of their self and then of other people's self. The weird thing about this model is that you need to get the person to become more aware of other people's self more than you need to get them aware of their own. Because they already know about their self that it's diminished. But they learn how to grow their own self by becoming aware of other people's self and being concerned about other people's self more than by just being selfish. As a matter of fact, if they're selfish, they will diminish their self, whereas as if they are concerned about other people's self, they will expand their self. So the model of therapy I'm talking about always involves them doing something to be helpful for others. And I'm not talking about just with a job and getting paid. I'm talking about with a life that repays them through the development of themselves, the redevelopment of themselves. The process is fairly intricate. I'm not going to go through every detail. It must involve individual psychotherapy where the person goes through examples of what they're going to be doing in the next few days, 2 weeks, to improve their self by improving their ability to understand and help other selves. And every session has to involve a remedy for some of the diminishment of the self. There are huge amounts of this. It takes a lot of effort. Several hours a week of psychotherapy in the beginning, individual psychotherapy, at least two in the mid part and one at the end, and then another hour of group therapy after about 8 to 10, or depends, weeks of individual therapy. Why not put a person into group therapy right away? Because they don't have the individual models they need to understand to be able to effectually deal with other people's selves. You put them in group therapy before they get that in individual therapy, they get worse, not better. Their self further diminishes if they have a psychosis. Psychotic people in group therapy at the beginning of their treatment is about as insane as the people are themselves. It's nuts to do it. Probably malpractice, but by today's standards, nobody understands it anymore. So, hey, we'll try anything. What the heck? We do it with our alcoholics. Why not do it with our psychotic people? All right. So, in the approach in psychotherapy for psychotic people, the therapist must be directive and not non-directive. What does that mean? Directive means the therapist takes charge of the person's self, allows the personality to still be in control. It's a difficult thing, because if you diminish the control of the personality, it will rebel. It will either not come back to psychotherapy, or it will become nothing but argumentative and fight. It will do that in any rate for the first 5 to 10 minutes of each session anyway, just let you know who it is. But the skill of a psychotherapist is to change and improve the structure of the self through giving experiences in the therapy session that are somewhat made up and somewhat different from what the person is experiencing at the present time, but what you want them to eventually do, and give them a chance to model and to interact with what we call imaginary circumstances, but seem very real to them during the psychotherapy. There are many models for doing this. I'm not going to explain them tonight, but they are all directive. You can't use a non-directive approach, which is to just listen to somebody and then feed back to them what you think you're hearing them say in both words and feelings. That makes them feel worse, and it reduces their self. It doesn't increase their self. It's perfectly okay to use non-directive methods in neurotic people, provided you don't use it in the specific areas where their self is damaged. And it's okay to use it with people with twisted personalities or personality disorders, because they like the fact that you're paying attention to them. And they like the fact that you seem to commiserate with their feelings, and they get some idea of what it means to have empathy for other people, which they usually lack. Those are good things to use, and that's what non-directive therapy is. But if you don't use non-directive therapy except for a brief minute or two here and there in dealing with a psychotic person, they need direction. But the direction can't be of the subconscious. It's direction of their conscious with the permission of the subconscious, always like a hawk watching you and making sure that you're not going to usurp its role. Instead, you let the person kick and scream, and, you know, they call you bad things, or whatever it wants to do, while you help that person to improve its ability to deal with the world outside of that therapy session in higher and more, we'll say, age-related ways, greater age, more maturity. And the personality says, hey, this is working. Okay, I'm coming back to therapy because it's working. It's working. How fast does it take? I've seen results within 20 minutes to 30 minutes in a very badly psychotic person. If you know what you're doing, you've got to be really skillful with this. And you can't have an agenda that lies outside of improving the self of the psychotic person. What else do you need to do? You've got to connect the person to their higher self. They've got to sense that there's something greater than just going to work, doing certain activities, even creating something on a mundane level. Their life has to be connected to something so great, so big, it's so huge, that it makes up for for what seems to be missing, so they have lost in their lower self. It's the light of God that is an important element of psychotherapy. I've never met a psychotherapist who is any good, who didn't in some way believe in spiritual existence. Ever. I know the conflicts that Freud had and all the issues about whether God existed for certain people or not. But the point is, I've never met anybody that could do good psychotherapy that didn't have a highly spiritual side. And that's the truth. You don't have to believe me. And if you're an atheist, you're probably a condemning it. If you're an atheist and you're a psychiatrist, a psychologist, or a psychotherapist, psychotherapists could be either psychologists, psychiatrists, or in some cases, they don't have to be either. But there is no question that they have to have, if they're going to be effective in my mind, they're going to need to have a very strong spiritual side to be good. Now, when does the spiritual part come in? Well, I start usually within about 30 minutes of the very first session. Why is it so important to bring this in to a person who has such a obvious problem with their lower self? Well, because the real nature of the problem is not just the fact that lower self has shrunk, it's that there has been some significant disturbance with their soul. Remember, to go back to the beginning of the show, as I tried to describe it, we're kind of going full circle here, but the soul is trying to connect with the subconscious part, the personality, while its strong consciousness is trying to get through to the consciousness of the person, so that everything together is going to become eventually conscious. Even the subconscious will not remain subconscious. Now, the personality is greatly fearful of becoming conscious because it thinks it's going to die. So in order to change that, the soul is so incredibly loving to the personality, this is hard to understand, that the personality, even if it lets the soul touch it for even a few seconds, goes, ooh, okay. It becomes, I'll use the word loosely, seduced by the love of the soul. And it happens in a way that you can actually palpably feel and visually see during the therapy process. The patient sees it, and the doctor sees it. It's the wonder of all of creation that we can see it under the most strange of circumstances. And as this takes place, and it usually takes place after, like, is it 20 minutes to a half hour of the session, it happens in each session, kind of like that. The person just takes on a glow. They suddenly, literally become someone else. And the self and the relationship between the self and the personality is no longer the personality is going to control the self as much as the personality is going to love the self. Now, you might say, well, I think I love myself more. The fact of the matter is that most people's subconscious does not love their conscious, their self. They sometimes like their self, but they don't love their self. Because in order to love their self, the self cannot be selfish. And in order for the self not to be selfish, it has to do the majority of the things it does for others more than for itself. Are you following? So what we really want is the personality to love itself. And then the personality becomes revealed to the self because it no longer fears the self, as it fears its own soul as well. if there's anything it's conscious to. Because remember, it never gets much beyond 10 years old, for everything. It isn't like some great super being. It's very controlling. It does try to keep us alive. It's needed to protect us when we're very young. But it also allows us to become slaves. It allows us to become enslaved. Because a 10-year-old still wants to follow everybody else, even if you're only 12. That's what's a parent or an adult. You don't, it isn't the kind of being that on its own can survive. It needs its lower self, but it wants to have more than a need for its lower self. Eventually, it wants to learn to love its lower self. And it can only do that when its lower self is doing something even more amazing, which is loving others. Gradually, this whole process by the therapist has to be revealed in the individual sessions, and then eventually, if you get enough people together with the same therapist, this is very important, then the group becomes an extension of the therapy. If you put somebody in that group who isn't at that stage, they go down the tube. If you put somebody in the group who's against their group in some way, then they become a destructive element to themselves and the group will want to get rid of them. So therapy groups have their place. There is no question about it. Best to be all from the same therapist. If not, then therapists who are functioning in similar ways in their therapy model. How effective is this? Tremendous. Does it work? Almost without failure, if you really are good at it. Is there a reason to limit the people who do this in some way so that you don't have people who don't understand this? Yeah, how about everybody who doesn't understand what I talked about tonight should not be doing psychotherapy? At one point, I was the president, that was my official title, of the State Psychotherapy Association, Arizona Association of Psychotherapy. Here in this state. And I tried to actually make it that somebody couldn't even join that association unless they had the rudiments of this whole structure that I'm talking about. Now, some people really liked that idea, but eventually I had to give in to the concept that at least they had to have enough training to not do some really, really bad things. Not that they were going to follow every construct of the model that I'm talking about tonight, because that's a little going a little over the top in a profession where maybe a third of the people didn't believe it got it. So, and they were social progressives and whatever. So you got to realize that this is not something that you're going to find every day. And from what I'm being told, you might not find it anywhere. Boy, that's good. Why didn't I stay in it? Because after not quite 20 years of training and doing it, I thought it would be better to teach, and not just teach psychotherapy, or I did some of that too, but teach about the bigger things behind this. Even in this show, although we're talking about, esoteric psychology and the causes of psychosis, we're really talking about things that are much bigger. We're really talking about the soul and the nature of God and how this all plays into how you get healthy these days and stay healthy. But let's talk about the question of mood, because many people say, well, I have a mood disorder. Yeah, well, if you have a neurotic mood disorder, that type of issue can be dealt with somewhat by being taking what is known as a tricyclic or a MAO type of drug. These are two different kinds of drugs. Shouldn't be taken together, usually. That relieves some of the, we'll call it, energy that is bound up in the midbrain of a person. And it affects the subconscious. It allows a person to... So the personality becomes less repressive, particularly of anger. It's an effective thing for some people. A lot of people use them. Some people are helped. Too many people use them too long without having proper therapy to deal with the damage to their self. these drugs don't really help psychotic. Why not? Because the psychotic person doesn't just have damage to their self. They have a diminishment of self, and they regress to very young years. And they need their personality, because that's the only thing that's keeping them alive. When the personality is diminished further by taking a tricyclic or a monoamine oxidase inhibiting drug, they may kill themselves, because the personality is there to keep them alive. And if you diminish it when there's not much self, that's a very dangerous position to be in. What about drugs like lithium? Lithium can be effective because lithium reduces the amount of mania. The flight of ideas can be significantly reduced. It's toxic, though. And because it's toxic, it has other negative effects on the way the person uses their brain. So the person, like in the other neuroleptic types of drugs, doesn't like the feeling of this reduction in their ability to think when they really want to think. Not when they have flight of ideas, but when they have some interesting, good idea, they would like to be able to think more. Lithium can affect that. Now, there's a thing called lithium orotate, which is a more natural way of using. Maybe, for some people, that might work. It's very mild, and it won't affect hypermania, but it might affect hypomania in most people. So those are the things to consider. What are other kinds? Well, there's some new stuff out there that also does similar kind of activity with lithium, but you still have to be concerned because they all have these toxic effects, not just on the brain, but on the whole body. They can kill organs unrelated seemingly to the brain, but everything's connected together. You have to be careful. That's all I can say. I'm not against psychiatry. I'm not against drugs, because sometimes that's the only way you can save someone who's really gone too far. If you can catch them really early, drugs may not be necessary. But really early is before anybody almost ever thinks of going to see somebody, the psychopath. It's just the truth. And that's unfortunate. So, yeah, if you can catch it real early, psychotherapy could be used without drugs. But today, I don't know if that's true in most circumstances involving psychosis. What should we do, then, in terms of our overall system, to change the system to become something, we'll say, that is more humane and that is effective? Well, the first thing is to not lock up people, which is seldom done anymore anyway, for very long periods of time, which causes a thing called institutionalization. If a person is like hebephrenic or catatonic or some severe kind of schizophrenia, you've got to get them out of that. But believe it or not, that could be done with some of the modern neuroleptics and some other kinds of activity. And psychotherapy is effective after a couple of weeks or less of treatment with those drugs. So there is no reason to keep people locked away in some kind of institutional environment. There is a need for a special kind of a cold facility where a person can check in and out as they need to on literally a daily basis, come and go as they want, and get psychotherapy at least three times a week if they have an active psychosis. Active only means, by the way, not by the present nonsense definition of active psychosis, but active means that it is that their life is being controlled by the severe reduction of self. They are highly regressed and autonomous. That's an active psychosis. Don't go into the nonsense definitions which mean nothing, because they're deliberately tailored to get some people to manipulate others in terms of trying to affect their treatment. It's not a good way of dealing with it. So when we deal with, we need facilities that have a kind of, almost a model of, you're here to get well. Welcome. Here are things you can do today. Here's a person you can see here, set up a plan. A plan has to be set up for each person to help them to increase their self a little bit every day. And all kinds of activities have to be arranged. Some of them, maybe the person can even earn them a little money at. But most of them are designed, all of them are designed, to increase the self and to help the person become more spiritual. Here's the rub. If this is going to be done in some non, we'll call it private way, if government has anything to do with it, then you have this issue. Well, it can't be spiritual because you have to have a separation of state and religion. Well, I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about God. And if we still pay with dollar bills for everything, it says in God we trust, then we certainly can trust a little bit in God when we're doing psychotherapy and having an effective model to deal with the most severe of mental illnesses that are called psychosis. Okay, I made my pitch. If that isn't going to work, then we have to have private institutions where people can go and get this done. They are almost non-existent. People who are psychotic cannot be treated like they have a drug addiction or that they have some kind of anxiety condition. Well, they do. Their anxiety is that they're afraid of death because they don't have a self or they feel their self is going away day to day. But that's normal to be anxious about that. Wouldn't it be for you? I mean, if you every day you wake up, you have less self than the day before, would you not be anxious about that? I would. If you weren't anxious, you'd figure there's something really wrong with you, right? The anxiety comes from repressing the fear. Could you just face the fear of it? Yeah, there are some models that work in therapy on a very temporary basis to get people to actually face the fear, to reduce the anxiety. But with psychotic people, you can't dare do that because they don't have enough self to compensate for the diminishment of self that comes through breaking through the repression. It just doesn't work. It will work on any rocket person. It doesn't work on psychotic people. Don't try it if you're a therapist. I tell you, it drives your patients into complete breaking. All right. So you create a model for each person. Each person's going to be unique. There are no cookie-cutter recipes for this. You're going to have a model, and it will change as the person self-develops. They'll be part of the system of creating the model. And people will be assisting them in helping them in doing that model every day. Cell phones are great. They can call in and say, hey, I'm over here at the restaurant, and I can't order my food. I'm too afraid to do it. Help me. And then, you know, the therapist says, okay, what I suggest to you, John, is that you pretend that you're ordering for somebody else. Let's say you have a good friend sitting across from you. Pretend that friend is there. I don't want you to hallucinate the friend there. I don't want to make you schizophrenic. You just pretend the friend is there and order for him or for her because she needs help. See if you can do that. Even if it's a little order, just order a drink, a non-alcoholic drink, and see how it goes. Can you do that for me? I'll stay here on the phone while you try. I know it doesn't sound like much. You think that's ridiculous, right? That's what therapy is about. It's one little step at a time. And it isn't what most people think it is. It's absolutely not what most people think it is. It's something so unusual that you don't experience it in normal life. People don't do that sort of stuff normally, right? But you've got to do those kinds of things in psychotherapy to help someone, even if it's over the phone, although I don't recommend the phone for normal psychotherapy. But if someone is in a circumstance and they need some assistance, anything is better than nothing. All right, so I'm hoping now, but I'm looking at the time here, I just realized that. We've got like 5 minutes left. Okay, so let's try to bring this all together. I was going to sum this up 5 minutes ago, but I got lost in what I was talking about. So let's try to do this. There, basically are two major reasons, two kinds of reasons, that people deal with a reduction of self. And those reasons are more specific to the individuality of the person and maybe genetics. And one is to compensate for the loss of self by creating an altered reality that the person, their subconscious mind, creates changes to their perception so that they actually hear things. Sometimes they really hear things, by the way, that are true, that are coming in from possessions. That's a whole other thing I didn't mention. But sometimes they're made up by the personality. And sometimes they're distorted. And sometimes the personality will create a whole array of changes in the knowledge base of the person so that they're living an altered life because they have a fantasy going on that isn't the real world. If they react to the real world by feeling relieved, it's like living in your own fantasy. You live in it. And so it's its own kind of tranquilizer. It relaxes the person. They feel better. It reduces their anxiety level because they're so afraid of death. In every psychosis, the fear of death is a real and tangible part of the psychosis, even if it's repressed, which it isn't. The person regresses. They regress because they are losing their self every day the psychosis goes on. Every day. There's some loss of self. Unless they're in therapy, unless they're taking certain drugs, then the self can go the other direction. It is a two-way street. It's harder to climb up once it's completely broken. But if anything's possible, so don't give up. The other way it's expressed is through the depression and mania, which is more common. And so people are having a lot of depressive, manic, and or manic episodes. And these expressions is another defense to the fear of death and that fear of being repressed, causing a lot of anxiety that the person then deals with, not by creating a different reality, but the way they deal with the existing reality is altered. They either choose to not interact with the reality, which is called depression, or overreact with the reality, which is called mania. If they overreact a little, it's called hypomania, and they have flight of ideas and flight of change of perception and what they're doing from, one hour to the next. It could be even a day or so. If it's hypermania, it could be in minutes. Their perceptions change and what they're focused on. Their thought is changing, and they're never dealing with much of anything, so they feel better because very little is called upon them from their diminished self to deal with. It makes them feel better. They do get burned out from it. The thought is going so fast, and there's so little content that comes through to them, the meaning of their life becomes less and less. Even though they're doing all these things that seem to be active, they aren't getting much meaning out of it. No more than actually when they're depressed. And so they can psychophonically swing between the depression and between the mania, be it hypo or hyper, and that's even worse for some people. But they can't stop it. They may be depressed for long periods and swing to the mania. By the way, in the middle part, while they're swinging, they could also do something terrible, take their own life. Or if they get possessed, they can be maybe nudged to take the life of someone else. People can get possessed in an older system, and it's a bad thing. The possessing entities are usually very dark, if not evil, and they want to destroy God and destroy life. The whole system is designed basically to get rid of the soul or the connection with the soul, as far as the dark side is concerned. So they use mental health as their weapon, and weapon on society sometimes to kill people and do terrible things. Mental health is a big issue. It's huge. Esoteric psychology helps us to see the hidden issues, and the causes of psychosis, I hope, have been revealed today through this show. Certainly, I could have talked for days on this subject. But you guys aren't out there to try to do psychotherapy. You've got to try to figure out how we can change our society to making a better place, so all live better and live a much more meaningful existence. And nothing is more lacking in meaning than being psychotic. Well, I'm out of time. That's it, yeah. I got as much out as I could. And until next week, This has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.